This is the Canadian Society of Cinematographers podcast. Join us as Canada's cinematographers discuss the tools and techniques they use in shaping the aesthetics of their current projects.
This podcast features Director of Photography Kim Durko, CSC, in conversation with Carolyn Wong of the CSC. This interview was recorded on March 15th, 2019, in Toronto.
Here we are with Kim Durko, CSC, for a little podcast chat. So we've known each other for a long time. It's really nice to sit here and talk. What have you been working on lately? Is there something interesting?
I've been working on some interesting projects. First of all, thanks, Carolyn. It's great to talk to you. We have known each other for so many years. It's amazing, the women coming up in the CSC. It's great. You've been a big one, a big part of that. No, I've been very busy the last 2 years, actually. I was shooting a TV series for BET, which was like a legal drama called In Contempt.
Yes, I saw that. I saw your new website, actually. It's very nice.
I'm still struggling to get releases of In Contempt so I can make a better website and release stuff. That's something that, huge topic, that in the IA 667 and the DP committee, we've been struggling to try and get the rights to use the material that we create to promote ourselves. Mm-hmm. And most DPs have it in their contracts, but it gets into a whole legalese when the DCP, when the films are being finished, that you can actually get a copy so you can use it to promote yourself. It's very tricky, but that's a huge other
topic for another day, but it is
an interesting topic. No, so I completed a series for BET, 10 episodes, and then I've been busy shooting. I shot a feature for the Saska Sisters.
Yes,
which is a remake of David Cronenberg's film Rabid from the original 1977.
Yeah, I'd love to talk about that.
Sure.
Okay. Sure. So, how did you get this project? How did it land on your lap?
Well, okay, this is funny because I think the next person that you should interview should be Mark Irwin, because Mark Irwin shot The Fly, and the Saskas, who are fabulous horror movie filmmakers, indie horror movie filmmakers, they adore Cronenberg, and they had approached Mark Irwin, who shot The Fly, if he would shoot this film for them, Rabbit, and he was unavailable because he was book shooting other films.
Ah.
So I owe Mark Irwin a cappuccino or more than that, but so they gave me a call, I guess. I don't know. I guess they'd seen some of my stuff, and they gave me a call. I went into the office. We just started talking about women in horror, and we just got on like a house on fire. I adore them, and we had a great, great time shooting the film. It was just like, you know, go, okay, let's do it. But it is funny that they wanted Mark Irwin. So
yeah,
I'm very happy, Mark, you were busy.
Yeah.
Thank you, Mark.
So how do you approach a project in prep? Like, do you read the script? Do you take notes off the top? Or, you know, how do you generally approach that?
I generally try to work from, like, the page on my first read. I usually read a script once, just for fun, just for the story, like I was reading a novel. Then I go back to page one, and I read it as a cinematographer. And, of course, some things will slip through on that first read, visual ideas. But when I read it the second time, it's about trying to use the words on that page to inspire myself to think of some new visual ideas to offer up to the directors. So then I go from that, you know, second or third reading into a creative discussion with them. So that's kind of my initial process. But I love movies so much, and I love reading so much. I love to just read the story the first time. And I think that my kind of initial reaction and my, you know, my first time read gives me like a really strong sense of the tone of a project, unless it's not well written or something, and it doesn't come across, right? But so reading Rabid for the first time, it's completely different characters, different character names. It's a, I may not use the word feminist, but it's a seen through the eyes of women version of the Cronenberg original. And I'm a huge Cronenberg fan as well. So I was bringing all that baggage of Rabid and Shivers and Videodrome because this film is a body horror, which Cronenberg's sort of the king of body horror. So,
but how can it not be from a woman's perspective? It's so, even without saying that, it is just going to be. They may be making a point of it, or I you know, the Saska sisters, maybe, do they, or do they just do what they do?
Well, the Saskas just do what they do in their amazing way. They're incredible people to work for. They're super smart, super creative, but the idea of the women in horror movies has, you know, a lot of discussion has, there's been a lot of writing, there's a lot of people who hate horror movies, who find the subjugation of women in horror movies to be really problematic. And the Saskas take that and invert it. And they did that with their other film, American Mary, where they try to reverse what has been called in like theoretical writing, like the male gaze or whatever, where you have your, you know, teenagers have sex, therefore the monster comes and kills them, right? Like in, you know, at Crystal Lake or in Halloween. So they have a really pro-woman aesthetic. So where it gets kind of crazy is as they describe scenes that might be violent or have creative, you know, body parts, they're doing it from a woman's perspective. And I find that fascinating because I've been inspired by women in horror movies, like Jamie Lee Curtis in Halloween, Nancy in, you know, all of the Sigourney Weaver in Aliens, like the women who have been heroes in horror movies were a big part of my sort of movie growing departure.
Almost like a little dream job for you.
This was a dream job for me. It was totally a dream job, yeah.
Do you shot digital?
Yeah, we shot on Alexa Mini. I love Mini because I love to move the camera around. One aspect of this female gaze that we were using in this film was that I had really wanted to work with Paula Timchuk, who's been a longtime IATSE camera assistant for years and now is a camera operator, an excellent camera operator. And I've always tried to get her on a show, and she was finally available. So I was like, this is so cool, because it's like the Saska is trying to redo a female gaze, and I can bring in this great camera operator that happens to be a woman. It was not a affirmative action project in any respect. I just wanted to work with Paula. And then because I love to move the camera around, the discussion with Saska's about, are we going to do Steadicam as A camera or Steadicam as B camera? And it came down to, you know, A camera's going to be Steadicam. We're going to be moving that camera like a lot. And there's night exteriors in the street and car shots and all this stuff. So we decided we're going to have a lot of Steadicam. So I was thinking of all of my usual fabulous, you know, regular suspects in Toronto that I would pull in to do Steadicam. I was finding they were all booked on other shows. And it was like, you know, I'd call up someone I'd just worked with and they'd be like, I've got overlap, I can't do it. So we broadened our scope. And I remembered working in Vancouver with a woman Steadicam named Tamara Jones, who is a crackerjack, like amazing Steadicam operator. And I tentatively went into the producers and said, can we bring somebody to Toronto from Vancouver? And it was like, absolutely, because Saskas had worked with her actually on a film in Vancouver and they loved her. So the shorthand of the director talking to the A camera operator was reduced because it wasn't going to be a new person they were learning to meet. So they pulled for it and we ended up with A camera chick, Bravo camera chick, and myself and two women directors. So
wow.
All like not really intended. All out of quality selection. You know, there was no, I don't think the Saskas ever had an idea, you know, as I mentioned, they were going to hire Mark Irwin. You know, I think they had an idea of being so pro-woman in their production that they wouldn't consider men for jobs, right? So, so it was interesting. It was really interesting.
Where was it? Where did you shoot it?
Toronto and Hamilton.
Yeah.
Like, we had a lot of VFX. But because it wasn't, you know, a huge budget feature, you know, we weren't going to go 4K or 6K for everything. So we would just we would upgrade if we needed to do some kind of VFX that we knew was going to happen. But the main part was the kinetic movement of the camera on the Steadicam, and the Mini really helped with that. And it also helped with handheld stuff that we were doing, you know, with both cameras and just like being able to travel and be in small places.
Did you approach lighting with, I guess, with a horror in mind, or was it because I know you don't really do it realistically. I mean, I guess to an extent. I mean, you talk about that. I'm just interested whether you'd go, okay, this scene is really horror-ish, so should we go dramatic? Or do we want to make it realistic to make that horror more right. sort of connected to today?
Well, I am a big fan. My approach to films often in my developing my look with the director is to discuss the palette. Obviously, I think every cinematographer probably does that. But I come from a background of color theory from art school. And so that's like my favorite part. So it was great to talk with Saskas, who are very into cult genres of historic horror films. So they were big fans of Dario Argento's movie like Suspiria and Opera. The use of kind of hard light and very saturated colors, something they talked about right from the beginning. So that was really exciting because it's not really what I would have initially, I would have maybe thought about trying to be more realistic to make the horror more emphasized, right? So we kind of had a lot of discussion back and forth about that. And we ended up using a lot of saturated color, although lighting it in a very, very naturalistic way. So a lot of things that are available to use now that we haven't been able to use before really just fell in my lap, like the Sky Panel Lights by Airy, where what we did was we sat down with a production designer with like a flip book of gels like you used to do in the old days, and we would program the gel curves into the sky panels. So we were using crazy great colors, all cut with white or natural daylight. So the film has a kind of unique mix of the super saturated tones mixed with like a real reality. So it's kind of blended.
Oh, that still that you showed me, that was a very realistic lighting, that still. That's why, you know, I asked the question just about lighting.
An apartment. Yeah, there was an apartment in the lead character, Rose, who's played by Laura Vandervoort, who was amazing, by the way, as a scream queen. She was incredible. And we did a kind of a tobacco-y color tone coming through an apartment window. And that tone is echoed, you know, through the film. But one of my favorite things to do, luckily we were shooting that in a loft in Hamilton, and one of my favorite things to do is to put a 4K with light tools through a window into an apartment, and it's like, I just love that look. And so that's what we did all the time in her apartment, and then when it got bloodier, we added red inside, you know, so, but the look was very naturalistic and pretty from the outside.
Have you ever shot as much blood on a shoot before as this?
I have never shot as much blood on a shoot before, no. We had really great VFX guys. We used a lot of plastic pools of blood on the ground, and that was a bit of a challenge to light. Mm. There were some VFX, like we were trying to maximize the VFX budget. So whatever dollar isn't spent coloring in a pool of blood gets to go to a splatter, for example, right? And so they could spend more time and money making that look good and better. So we had these wonderful plastic pools of blood that we would use all the time, which provided a pretty challenging lighting.
What were they made lighting. Out of? Just because they're super too reflective, perhaps?
They're matte. They're made to look like matte plastic, so they weren't too reflective. But it's still very hard because you're often key lighting 3/4 backlight, you know, on a scene, especially at night. And so it was a little bit of a challenge with some of our plastic blood pools, but we got through to the end. But we used a lot. And so then the bigger challenge then was matching the reds, the blood that we were provided. This sounds so hilarious to be talking about. But
yeah, no, I'm sure that is something that you have to consider, and at one point, when do you just sort of let it go because it's blood, and then if people are looking at the color difference, then they're not really looking at the story.
Yeah, it was more about reflection of the lights, okay. or an actor that, or somebody, the boom, or you know, it was more of those challenges on the large scale blood pools. Yeah. But it was fun.
Was there, now you talked, there was like night exteriors and that. I mean, was there any kind of like challenges on that shoot that, you know, were maybe problematic, but then you overcame them? There was good solutions. I mean,
I did have a lot of challenges. I mean, we were shooting in Hamilton for a lot of night exteriors where there would be, you know, dramatic scenes where our lead is following a guy down a city sidewalk, city street, and the challenge of getting permits for lighting all the city street or the two blocks away that you see in the background that you want to have something, you know, visible on. And you always want to make it as big as you can make it to give the film some scope, right? So we did, we came down to a system where we would scout and devise a lot of the locations based on the available light that was coming out of storefronts, right, the street lights. And it's actually hell now to do that because a lot of the cities are retrofitting. Like there was a time when all the streetlights were tungsten, and then it changed to sodium vapor, and then it changed to mercury vapor mixed with sodium vapor, and now it's LEDs, which are way too bright for an 800 ASA camera, right? So there was often a lot of challenge trying to flag off lights that were LED city lights. You know, for me, the tungsten lights are always looking the best on at being recorded. But I think it's a real problem cinematographers to be doing night exterior because every 2 inches is a different color temperature. You have to embrace it at some point.
So, right, yeah. If it's a contemporary thing, it's what it looks like.
It's what it looks like. So our solution to this, to walk and talks, for example, where we couldn't like put a light on a lift in a parking lot or something, which is what we would do in the background generally, would be to use light mats, which are LED, and you're able to, because they're RGB, control them so you could tweak them a little warmer, a little cooler based on the ambience that the crazy mix of everything else was doing.
Right, find a medium, like sort of like compromise what
exactly
makes sense.
And sometimes you would even use the contrast. So you would use more of a tungsten if it's the actress you were pulling down the street in a Steadicam shot. And we'd have our electrics holding the lights with a big diffusion in front of it, walking backwards, but these things are so much smaller than they used to be, and we used to carry batteries and, you know.
Well, I know.
It's much easier.
You can run off your watch or something.
Exactly. Turn the camera on with your phone and run the light off your watch.
Well, and the power, it takes no power, so you can really, and they're so small, you can actually just, you can tuck them in places. Like, you know, the classic is, you know, night car interiors. There you go. Nothing.
Absolutely.
And it's so sensitive too, the digital sensors. And you shot this all. Is 800 ASA your standard go-to?
Yeah, that was my go-to. I think, we could have slid it up, but I like to stay in the same territory so that I know when I'm doing my color grade where I'm sliding. So we didn't really have to do any noise reduction or anything on the film. Sure. So it was good. But to do an aside on your car lighting, I love doing car stuff. And to jump over to Incontem, we did a massive car scene down University Avenue, Adelaide Wellington Loop in a New York taxi with like 10 New York taxis behind it. And I'm from the school of, well, it started out with like a 12-inch Kino with a battery in the car taped to the dash, right? And then it got better. Then it was a 9-inch nail taped under the odometer in it, and then that was better. But now it's like it's a small little piece of LED tape that you tape on and you dim it down because it's way too bright. So it's a wonderful progression.
You probably plug it into the lighter.
Yeah. Well, we actually did great stuff on that. Mark Manchester was my key grip on that, and he's, as everyone knows, he's a lovely character. And we had a movie bird on our camera truck, which we put a Libra head on. And to get back to the whole lighting progression, the beauty was we were able to do moves with the camera on the remote head, like off of the windshield into the side window, which, you know, 10 years ago, if that was a Kino flow in the car, you would have seen the damn light because it's 4 inches wide or whatever. Mm-hmm. So we were really liberated by that in a way. As long as we can get these LEDs to stop flickering when we dim them down, we get that done in the next 2 years, we'll be good.
So Incontem was shot here.
It was, yeah.
And it's supposed to be an American city.
It's supposed to be in New York, in Manhattan.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Well, on your website, I did see some little trailers. It was great. There was a lot of energy. It was a bit intense, you know.
It was very intense. So,
was it a US Canadian co-pro? Or was it
no,
just US
BET?
BET?
BET is Black Entertainment Television, which used to be like a music video, but now they do programming. Like now it's a regular dramatic. They have shows like The Quad, a lot of series.
Yeah. It looks really interesting. Great. Yeah, so how did you, you know, you started in film and then you went to digital. So are you finding you're shooting more digital now, or is it the odd thing is film? Or
I would give my eye teeth to shoot film in film.
Ah, right, okay. Now. Listen to that, because everybody.
I haven't done so in maybe 6 or 7 years. And I still love that medium. I know we've moved forward, and I was very resistant to digital at the very beginning. But now I've embraced it. I love Alexa. Alexa has convinced me, I think.
Well, how did you approach your lighting on those first digital projects? Did you use your meter, or do you just did it by the monitor? Like,
I still used my meter on the first projects. I mean, the first projects I did were in standard def, right? And we were looking at, I mean, really the first projects I did that were standard def HD, we were looking at 250 ASA equivalent, right? Which was even a downgrade from the film prior to that, which was maybe 400 or 320 or 500 ASA. So we actually had to use more light in that first era. And it actually probably shows in a lot of people's work now when you look back at the kind of series work on TV and stuff in that transition.
Yeah, that's true. Bright. Yeah, things were too bright, but now everyone's pushing.
Oh, yeah.
Push how dark things can go. And then that they know the variables and the progressions with the technology, they can pull things up like...
It's incredible. But I did still use my light meter for night exteriors. And then I kind of tossed it away and I was just using the waveform for a few years and the monitor on set. But I've gone back to using my light meter because I saw David Makin using it. I did some second unit on Rain and David was still walking. And Michael Story too. I was like, what are they doing? And I figured it out. It's like when they're using the really low end of the latitude and you're lighting a night exterior or something lit by a fire or a castle dark, you know, you can check the back corner and see that that's 5 foot candles on your light meter without running back to the monitor, etc. Right? You're still using your eye and everything, but it is a good, I'm not saying that those fellows used it the way I do, but it's a really great thing for doing like a night exterior on a street where you can walk down half a block and just make sure you don't have to add something there. You've got the 5 foot candle, so you're fine on the Alexa, right? So, you know, I've kind of gone back to picking up that light meter, which is interesting.
Yeah, no, yeah, that's great. I think...
Because it's mobile. That's the beauty of it.
And it's sort of a known entity, so like sort of a point of reference.
Right, right.
You know, and then how you apply that to digital. Because right. I think that DPs that started in film and are shooting it digitally, they have a little umbilical cord to their meter.
Absolutely.
You know, or a really good monitor, but they'll still... You know, check the little meter. Don't throw them away yet.
I don't think it's time to ever throw them away. I really don't. I think they definitely are useful. And I think, like, one of the things I've seen with the transfer to digital is how much people do watch the monitor, like everyone on set, from the director, which can sometimes be really bad, to the hair, and, you know, God bless them for caring and coming to check on the monitor. But there's a difference between being able to see what your work that you're really doing physically in front of you and always relying on the monitor. Like, there's a catch-22 there. It's great to check the monitor, but I think you really need to use your eyes to make your brain know how to do it instead of waiting till the TV looks good.
That's right. You know? We could totally be wrong with what's going there. So then you have to train your eye. Okay, what I see that looks good in real life, check the monitor, and so you have a reference. That's what it should look good looks like here.
Exactly.
Back and forth, like cover your bases.
And everyone's using a lookup table or Rec 709 when they're looking at the log C work, like the camera's got other information on it that may never be in the show or might be even more so, right? So I think you really need to trust your eyeballs.
So did you create a LUT, like, or do you shoot raw?
Well, log C, I mean, you're recording like a wider range, which is watched on set in Rec 709 normally. So unless you do set up LUTs for every scene, which very few of the films I work on, I have time to do that. But we kind of do like semi-grades, semi-LUTs. I had a really great DMT on Rabid, Dwayne Barak. He was fantastic. He's doing Designated Survivor right now. So we would tweak kind of a little bit of live tweaking as we go. And that's really a lot of fun. So you are kind of making a LUT. But I mean, you've gone through all of that in prep about, you know, how contrasty or whatever. But when you get into the post-production suite and you're looking at a P3, like a projection, once you're in the projection theater, if you're looking at the log C, I mean, it looks terrible. It's just a mushy, non-contrasty thing. So hopefully you've set all that up before of how you want it to look. As sometimes the Rec 709 looks good, but, you know, usually you're doing something different. Well, especially if the producers and directors are standing around the monitor looking at the log C, they're going to be like, fire this shooter, because it, you know, they want to see something close to what they're envisaged, exactly. Right?
Yeah, they don't understand.
And so that process, you know, that's something that, you know, some, of course, some directors and producers totally understand, but it's tougher, especially like for the people who shoot commercials. They want to see exactly what they're getting on set. So those LUTs are really developed before they're actually putting any data onto the drive.
When did you get your letters? Because you've had them for a while.
I've had them for a long time because I'm originally from Vancouver. And so I shot a feature film for John Grayson.
Yes, John Grayson.
I can't even remember when, like, you know, 2000 or something. Maybe less than that. Maybe like...
Which one? Which film?
Law of Enclosures I shot for John Grayson. So it might have been 1998.
Maybe.
Or something.
Could have been.
And then I did... and that was shot in Winnipeg. So what happened was I wasn't in IA 667 here, even though they had asked me to join as a second camera assistant. But I'd been shooting music videos. So I was shooting and there was not... I was dying to join the union and be a part of that. But I wasn't able to, for many reasons, switch to being a second camera assistant in order to join. So I was kind of on their radar. I don't know if it's some chick quota or what it was that I was on their radar, but whatever. I was able to work on permit in the prairies. So I ended up shooting a show for opening night that CBC used to do, an arts show. I did a show in Regina, and I did John Grayson's show. And so that would have been around the 2000. So that's when I would have got my letters after I did those two features, because they were looking at my, she's got feature credit as and permit under 669. So that's how I got into 667. Sideways, yeah.
So you didn't go to film school. You went to the Emily Carr. I went to Emily Carr.
I did take a film course there, but I wasn't intending to be a cinematographer at all. I wanted to be a curator. I studied art history and color theory, technical assistant in the photography department, because I was always loving photography just as an art form to look at. They were throwing out old equipment that they didn't really know. They were just recycling it. They were putting it in the bin. And so one of the TAs put a sign up that said free. And I kind of had a little passion for old objects, like older, not really antiques, but just sort of, you know, objects. There was this very strange black Bakelite round box with two handles on it and a big hole with a window in the front. And so I took it from this free pile and I asked the guy what it was. He said it's a developing tank for Super 8 and 16 film. So for some reason, I got it in my head. I went and I got a book on Muybridge and I refilmed a horse running that was originally photographed by Edward Muybridge. And then I went to the lab, Alpha Cine in Vancouver, and asked them, they would give me some little bags of chemicals and I would read how to do it. And I went home and I processed a little Super 8 film of Ruth kicking, which is, I think, a donkey kicking in a Muybridge thing, and showed it to the film instructor, who said, you should do something. And it was all downhill from there. I ended up going to the National Film Board in Montreal, where I worked as a trainee. And that's where I met Zoe Durst, who was...
So that would have been Studio D?
Studio D. Yeah. And that's where I met Zoe Durst, who was a huge inspiration to me as a cinematographer chick. And Susan Troe, both working there.
Yeah, I assisted for them both.
It was the first time, you know, I really didn't know about being a cinematographer. It wasn't like I'd set out to do it. I was just interested in the images. So I kind of went down this rabbit hole, and then I saw these two women shooting films, and I was like, hey, yeah, I think I might like to try that. So they were big inspiration to me, both of them.
Like, what were some of your early jobs? Or was there a job that was a breakthrough?
Well, I was always, because I went to art school, I had these friends who were always shooting films. They were like, it was like called time-based arts in that point. And there were people like Paul Wong. There were these artists. I shot films for Stan Douglas. I shot stuff that was in the Venice Biennale for Janet Cardiff and George Miller. And so these people were like saying, hey, come and shoot my art thing. And that was really where I, you know, sort of honed my craft, was shooting for artists, which was a wonderful world to be in. And then from there, I started shooting music videos, moved to Toronto. I was a focus puller for Doug Coe on a low budget feature, and I was so terrible. Doug, I'm so sorry. I was so terrible at that. And I went back to shooting music videos. Thank you, Doug. And anyway.
What was your first feature? The first feature was the John Grayson one? Or no, was there...
Let me think. I think that would have been my first real feature film. But so then I'd known John from the art world as well. So that was how that all kind of fell into.
No, I remember that you were from the art world.
Yeah.
That, you know, you did a lot of dance stuff and some unusual things and installation visuals and stuff.
Yeah.
That's great.
That's my background.
So what was the experience of working with two directors?
On Rabbit, Jen and Sylv Soska, who are like just completely smart and together, did scare me a bit. I was so thrilled to be doing the project, but I was a bit daunted by the fact that working for twin directors, it's like working for co-directors. And I didn't really know where, you know, how this was going to go. Even before we were on set, I found out it was very clearly delineated between the workflow of the two of them. And Sylv would be on set, like in my ear, we'd be talking about the shots, we'd talk about the plan séquence, we'd talk about the, you know, actors, you know, what they brought. And Jen, who would always be back and forth from the monitor, she would be with the VFX guys in the wardrobe room, okaying. And the two of them, brilliant, 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 trust each other so much. There was never a time when Jen came back to set with some prosthetic or something and Sylv would go, oh, no, that's not right. You know, it was always like right on, always perfect. So it was quite spectacular. It was almost like having a director with two brains who had twice as much time in prep and twice as much time in a day to deal with all the stuff. But they would have their moments. They were so polite. They would go, may I, Kim? And they would turn and talk to each other for a second. It's almost as though you were there. And then they'd quickly turn back and answer your question. It was very sweet. They're quite lovely.
Maybe in wrapping, is there anything any little bit of advice for young cinematographers out there that you wish someone had maybe told you?
I don't think I can give any advice to anyone who wants to be a young cinematographer. I would ask them, what do they want to do? Like, I think that people really need to clearly want to do this job because it's super hard. The hours are crazy. You're faced with challenges all the time. And so I think my only advice would be like, just make sure you really want to do this. And so just ask yourself, do you want to do this? And if you do, then go for it, because it's a great job, but it's a hard job.
This has been the Canadian Society of Cinematographers podcast. The CSC is a nonprofit organization that has been promoting the art and craft of cinematography in Canada since 1957. Find out more by logging on to thecsc.ca. Thank you for joining us.